My name is Victoria Matei.
My name is Olga Araceli.
And we are both undocumented women of color. All right. So welcome back to A Shot of Truth podcast. We're here recording in San Antonio, Texas, and we're here with someone that I admire a lot and look up to their work and just, I don't know, he's a fucking badass. So do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Abraham Diaz Alonso. I am originally from Monterrey, Mexico. So I'm from El Norte and I'm from the Rio Grande Valley in the southmost part of Texas.
So I want to ask you so many things about the work that you do at the border. But first, I kind of want to share a little bit about how we met and whatnot. And, you know, I usually ask people, like, how did we meet? But I'm just going to tell everyone my first impression of you. It was about a year ago in July at Trinity University. And I saw this dude in cowboy boots and, like, jeans and, like, a button-up or something. And I was like, how is this guy wearing this right now? It's super fucking hot. Because I was, like, melting. And then you had mentioned something about living near the border and doing border work. And I was like, oh, my God, this guy's a fucking badass. And I want to be his friend. And I would say quickly after that, we became friends. I don't know.
Now we're best friends forever.
Oh, best friends forever. No, fuck that. Not best friends. But my first impression of you was just that you're a badass. And I was like, ¿quién se cree con sus botas? And he's wearing them right now.
Yeah, I have to wear them. It's part of my, you know, everyday dress code.
Everyday dress code.
Yes, I have to follow it.
Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, we've been working. I mean, not working together, I guess, learning and growing together over the last year with the Dream Lead Institute. And I should mention that I am recording with various of the fellows this weekend, which I'm really excited about. So it's kind of like a DLI series. So I hope you all enjoy. But like Abraham had mentioned, he lives at the Rio Grande River. Or the Rio Grande Valley. Oh my God. As Abraham mentioned, he lives at the Rio Grande Valley, which we actually had an opportunity to go to as a fellowship, but we can bring that up a little later. But I want to hear about your work. What do you do for a living?
What I do for a living is a lot of everything and a lot of nothing at the same time.
I've heard you fucking say this before, dude.
So I do everything that there is to do. I work for a nonprofit called La Unión del Pueblo Entero. It's a nonprofit that was founded by farm worker rights activists Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez. And they created the United Farm Workers, eventually created the La Unión del Pueblo Entero in different states. So we focus on different issues. One of the biggest one is education access for undocumented students. The other one is immigration reform, permanent pathway to citizenship for undocumented folks in the country, and also fighting to keep a positive narrative in the border. Everything with just a bunch of branches and a lot of stuff other than that I do.
So I have never asked you this, but when did you come to the U.S.? Like, I've never asked you that. Like, what was that move like? Do you remember it?
I do. And I think I've shared it in very few spaces. But I came into the U.S. in 2002, which is about 17 years ago, going on 17 years. So I'm 25, turning 26 next month.
Ya estás viejo.
Yeah, same.
You were like, up. Same.
Same, yeah. So 17 years ago, we came to the States. My father was already working in the U.S., so we hadn't been living with him for a while. He was working and living in San Antonio, actually, where we're at right now. And then I remember, you know, just from one day to another, it was just, you know, my mom say, hey, you know, you're going to stay with your grandma, you and your sister, and me and your brother are going to go to the United States to meet up with your dad. So it was this kind of like hard, adventurous, not knowing, scary tale that was going on in my life. So they left, I want to say maybe like mid-July. And then eventually they had enough money to, you know, give my sister and myself the opportunity to come to the States again and join them in around December of 2002. So about 6 months I spent it living with aunts, with my grandma, until we were able to be reunited with them. Hard journey, everything in between happened. Mm-hmm. You know, living as a single child. I was living with a single parent at the time, not living with any parents for 6 months, trying to get through education and living in a very low-income community, living in poverty, and then eventually being reunited with your mother. So it was super of a hard track the whole time, but I think it's played out well. I'm still alive so far. I hope to live a while.
So how did you get involved with some of the work that you do at the border? I want to know, like, the beginning. When was, like, your awakening of, like, this is what I want to invest my life in, which, you know, obviously your community?
So I've always known I was undocumented, you know, since 2002, you know, just the way we came into the country. Graduated high school in 2012, and, you know, there was this average Abe from San Juan, Texas, who just didn't have documentations, who couldn't go to college because nobody told them they could. And then, you know, just eventually, somehow, miracle-wise, and through whatever the hard work means and opportunities that came down, I was able to make it to college. My second year of college, my best friend, Miguel, he had just transferred from UT Austin, and he learned about, you know, this fraternity that he really enjoyed. So I joined a fraternity my sophomore year in college.
I want to mention that Abraham is a, like, diehard fraternity bro.
Yeah, oldie fight. Yeah, so I joined a fraternity my sophomore year in college. And I think this was one of the spaces where I had the opportunity and I felt comfortable sharing that I was undocumented with other folks besides my high school counselor and besides my best friend, Miguel. So during the time that I was sharing that I was undocumented with my fraternity brothers, one of my fraternity brothers, his name's Luis, you know, reached out to me afterwards. And it was within the same day. He was like, hey, you know, I'm undocumented as well. At the time, I was undocumented, but also a DACA recipient, which still means I was undocumented. And he mentioned, you know, I'm also undocumented. I also have DACA. It's great to see somebody that's another person who's also undocumented within our fraternity. So it was very welcoming. There was no tension. And it just happened that in my crossing line, it was three of us who were undocumented, two of us who had DACA and one who didn't have DACA.
And all three of you were ready to kick ass?
Yeah, and all three of us were ready to kick ass. So it also just happened that Luis founded an organization at the university called Minority Affairs Council. And this organization, the work they did was focused mainly on helping undocumented students in the Rio Grande Valley be able to go to college, whether it was our community college or our local universities. So through there, I was able to, you know, start. It was just, so they actually bribed me to go into organizing.
They bribed you?
Yeah.
What did they tell you they were going to give you?
So I met Luis in September of 2013, yes. And in February, it was United We Dreams Congress in Phoenix, Arizona. Mm. So he was like, hey, you know, there's this great opportunity that you can join us. You have DACA. This is, you know, he introduced me to the whole movement and so on. And you would be eligible if you do some work with us. So I hadn't traveled outside, you know, the Rio Grande Valley, except once when I went to Los Angeles. So then I was like, hey, you know, it's a great opportunity. Mm-hmm. It's going to be free. I'm going to get to meet more people, and I'm also going to get to travel. So I was like, all right, let's do this. Some of the work that I did, you know, it was volunteering at DACA clinics. So I got to renew my own DACA there, and I did my own renovation or renewal, however you say it. And other things were like, you know, helping organize conferences and presentations and learning through all this stuff. So in the span of like October, November, December, and January, I learned so much that in February, I was traveling with 10 other folks in a big van, 16-passenger van, to Phoenix, Arizona, which was hell of a trip. Arizona's super hot. So I got to go to this, you know, I had this opportunity to be able to go to Phoenix, Arizona, where I met other undocumented folks, folks with DACA, got to learn about the campaign that we're going against, you know, the government allowing them to get driver's license. And I think it not only opened my eyes more than those 4 or 5 months, but also it gave me an opportunity to be, you know, say, I'm going to continue doing this. So that's like the very, very beginning
on how it started. How,
like, I got bribed into organizing.
Oh my gosh. And now you do it for a living?
And now, yeah, now I do it for a living. I help families who are low income, mixed status, undocumented, first generation Mexican American, to be able to go to college.
So I was so spoiled and got really lucky and was able to come a day early to go visit Abraham and kind of see some of the work that he's done. And I wasn't expecting what we did essentially, but he took a bunch of, were they high school students?
College students from Wisconsin.
They looked really young. but he took them to the border and just kind of like described what it was like and asked various questions. I got a lot of people thinking and got people like really emotional. And I'm sure you've done this. How many times have you done this? Like 100 times?
Yeah, I think every, at least once or twice a month I have to do kind of like this presentation that I do.
All right. So what are some of those things that you touch on? Because I think it's important, right? Like, I think a lot of the things that you mentioned that really resonated with me, one in particular was like the whole community at the border was scared when state troopers were being sent to the border because they're not trained to work with asylum seekers or immigrants or anything. They're trained to kill. And so like that like stuck with me, right? So like what are some more things that you kind of tell folks?
So one of the things that I could remember right now is the border narrative. So every time anybody and everyone speaks about the border, whether it's, you know, potential presidential candidates or it's governors or it's senators or congressmen or, you know, whoever talks about the border, they always have like this negative mentality about it, where it's like, you know, it's where these dust balls are going through the ground and it's like a shoot at will, fire everyone kind of place. But it's a really loving community, very welcoming. And I have that opportunity to show people who are not from the border communities the realities of it, where people would ask, you know, are you fine? But also show them the reality that it's been so polarized in the recent years. In 2014, with the unaccompanied minors who were coming in, you know, youth who were trying to seek an opportunity to, or just trying to get the same opportunity that I have. In the recent years, you know, 2017, 2018, 2019, families who are seeking asylum, how they've been mistreated in the past, you know, months, how implementation of negative border policies have incremented, how they've sent, you know, the U.S., you know, the National Guard, the Texas Coast Guard to the border to be able to assist, you know, and letting people know, like, you know, these folks, you know, they're the military, they're sending U.S. troops, the same ones we sent to Afghanistan and Baghdad and Iraq and other places. They're sending them to the border when these folks have been trained to kill the enemy. And then portraying families who are seeking asylum as the enemy really scared the communities in the border, because, you know, all of us saw them as the same as us, you know. It's 90% Hispanic in the Rio Grande Valley. So you can't distinguish somebody mm-hmm. who's brown skin, who's a U.S. citizen, so from somebody who's brown skin, who's undocumented, right?
But you see a lot of that racial profiling happening.
Yes. I think with language, it's
language
the most.
Is
I think
big one. Yeah.
If you can't distinguish folks because of skin color in the Rio Grande Valley, but they do discriminate based on their accent.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Border Patrol, ICE, the Coast Guard, the sheriffs, the state troopers, the local police. I mean, it's so many agencies that are based in just this 100 or less mile radius that really scares our communities. But overall, our communities have, you know, pushed back against this. I remember when they started the shelter by Catholic Charities,
mm-hmm.
It got overfilled with donations, like literally overfilled. the, you know, they had to say, you know, we have too many and we don't know where to put them. Local food banks were taking in their donations and taking them as they needed them. That's the reality of the border that I can see and that I continue to see over on. Other things that I do work on, immigrant youth, undocumented youth, helping them, you know, apply or renew their deferred action. Also, finding pathways for folks who are undocumented to get to high school. I train counselors, principals, so that they know that there was this law in 2001 that passed that allows undocumented students to go to college. So all of these things is just part of the grain of salt that I can give back.
So there's something you didn't mention that I was surprised you didn't mention, but I saw this in a video you sent me that you were in. This was like a while back, and you were kind of like pretend. You were literally doing role playing with community members about, like, you were being like harsh. You're like, "Let me see your license and registration. Let me see it." And well, like, what is that experience like? Because I know that like you have to put yourself in a different mindset. And like, yes, you know you're like acting, but you're really helping these people get prepared for that kind of situation.
Yes. So one of the things that I also do in addition to everything, is know your rights. So I help community members know what their rights are in case they get stopped by local police, the sheriffs, the state troopers, by Border Patrol, right? What to say, what not to say. And we do it in a way that community members feel welcome and included. So the way that we do it, or that I like to do it, is through a theater, right? I put on a hat that's a police hat. I actually bought, you know, at a local dollar store, those police and badges things and handcuffs.
I totally saw the badge.
So I play this hard police officer because that's the reality that people face. You know, police officers in 2019 aren't always easy on folks, especially undocumented. So I want them to feel, you know, there's tension in the room. I create that tension by saying loudly, you know, show me your documents, or, you know, what country are you from? Because then they question, so it's like, oh, like they see me smiling, they see me, you know, playing jokes. And then once I, you know, like put on those sheriff glasses, like I'm just hard and they're just like scared. And at the end they were like, oh, wow, like we've seen this happen, you know, with my family member who signed their own deportation, you know, who was deported because our local police called Border Patrol. So it opens their eyes. It reminds them of the reality that they have to face, but also it gives them the opportunity to know what to say when that happens. So it's another one of the things that I do.
So what are some of those things? I want to hear from someone directly working with these people at the border. What are some of the things that you encourage them to say and not say?
When getting stopped by police, first of all, is letting them know police stops you because they have suspicion or they believe you have committed something, right? A crime. And those things can be, you know, you were missing a taillight, you ran a stoplight, you were speeding and so on. So correcting that, right? Saying, hey, check your car. In case you are the ones listening, haven't checked your vehicle, check your brake lights, check your front lights to make sure they're working. Your license plates are there. Because our community doesn't do it. You know, it's sometimes we take it for granted. And then letting them know if they do stop you, check what's the reason for. Maybe they stopped you for speeding. And what happens when somebody's speeding? Well, they get a ticket, right? So we want our community to try to fight to get that ticket instead of, you know, being jailed and put in a prison because, you know, they were lacking a driver's license and so on. So I tell them, you know, hey, they're going to ask you for an ID. Do you have an ID? They'll say, yeah, I have an ID. I have my Mexican consulate card, my Honduran passport, right? But then living in the border, that opens up so many doors, right? It opens up the door so that the local police, the sheriff can call Border Patrol. And then I tell them, well, what other non-country ID do you have, right? And sometimes they have, well, I have my, you know, Costco card, or I have my library card, or, you know, I'm a parent volunteer at my son's school, and they give us an ID. You know, showing these documents instead of, you know, your El Salvadoran passport, that kind of like doesn't open that door to getting profiled and possibly opened up the opportunity to get deported. If they do, you know, end up being in a detention center, not signing, because once you sign that letter that pretty much ICE forces you to sign, then you're waiving away your rights to see a judge. You're waiving, you know, all the time that you've been in this country. You're saying you don't want to take it as credit. You're also signing that you do want to get penalized once you leave the country. All of these things come with your signature, mm-hmm. and you have the power to not sign, right? It might be horrible conditions inside the detention center. That's the reality. But also the reality is that if they do sign, then they are more prone to be killed in their home country, mm-hmm. you know, being, you know, extorted and so on. So making them have that choice of, like, which one do you choose? You know, we also offer an immigration attorney who can try to fight your case. And worst case scenario, then, you know, it's the worst case scenario that happens, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. So I've also seen that you've posted things along the lines of, like, hey, we're looking for donations for Catholic charities and other things like that. So, like, what does that generally look like?
So,
because I've never been to, like, Catholic charities or anything like that, and I can't imagine that it is the best, you know, like, the most comfortable thing to see, considering the circumstances. I mean, it's great, you know, that Sister Norma has this amazing organization, but, like, what is happening there?
So, recently, throughout this, you know, past half a year to a year, more families have been fleeing their home countries to seek asylum in the U.S., and many of them have been given their right to seek asylum, be reunited with their family. And ICE or Border Patrol releases them at the bus station. Mm-hmm. So picture Abraham, you know, coming from Honduras, traveling all of Honduras, El Salvador, the Central American countries, traveling through all of Mexico and getting to the Rio Grande Valley. Not once have they showered. They've eaten very few times. They haven't changed their clothes. They've been walking in the same shoes for, you know, days, weeks, or months. And they're taken to a detention center by ICE. And eventually, you know, they do get that right to seek asylum. And they're just dropped off at a bus station, right? So picture going to a bus station with no bus ticket, you know, with a language barrier, with a cultural shock, with trauma that you've been going through. What do you do, right? So Catholic charities have, you know, opened up their place to, you know, get the folks who are at these bus stations and then take them into their shelter, you know, provide a meal, provide a place to shower, giving them new clothing, you know, giving kids toys, you know, giving kids the opportunity to color, being in a place that has some moderate AC, that it's not, you know, tragic hot conditions like in Mexico, mm-hmm. or, you know, extreme cold conditions like at a detention center. Being able to rest in a mat, in a bed, instead of being on the floor with a tinfoil hat, or a tinfoil blanket. And then, you know, having folks from the Rio Grande Valley who speak Spanish and say, bienvenido a Estados Unidos. Ya llegaste aquí, you know, welcoming them and letting them know, like, you know, we're also immigrants, or, you know, we're here to support you. They've never had the opportunity of somebody to let them know, you know, would you like another meal? Mm-hmm. Are you cold? Would you like a sweater, a jacket? Hey, you know, asking a little girl, you want to play, right? These things that, you know, it might not mean a lot to many folks, but to people who have gone through all of this trauma, they get that opportunity. So one of the little works that we can do and that I do is be able to get, you know, donations, whether it's for shampoo, whether it's for soap, for toothbrushes, toothpaste, for pants, for shoelaces, for shoes, whatever it is that people can donate, we ask them to bring it into our office. And we were able to provide it directly to these families. So sometimes when we have volunteers, we create, you know, small Ziploc, 1 gallon bags, Ziploc bags, care packages that has, you know, a toothbrush, you know,
socks,
you know,
yeah,
crunchies for the hair, like things like that, right?
Crunchies for the hair.
Things, you know, little things that people sometimes say, you know, I have it at home, and, mm-hmm. you know, I don't use it, or I'm willing to spend $5 on, mm-hmm. you know, these things.
Yeah. So I have a few more questions for you, or actually a lot more questions, but what are we drinking?
Today, we're drinking Every Drop for Shiner is brewed in Shiner, Texas. So Shiner Bock, thanks for sponsoring us. You're not sponsoring us, but thank you for providing one of the best beers in Texas.
You beer. Think that's one of the best beers? Okay, you know what? I'm not going to fight you on that.
It is. It's also owned by Mexican immigrants now.
Mm.
So it's another reason to drink it besides its good taste. And you're drinking lemonade.
I'm drinking lemonade. Yeah, that's what I'm drinking. So I was going to ask you, I wanted us to take just like a quick breather because it's like a lot of stuff that you're talking about that I think a lot of people need time to like, you know, take in and understand, because like you're saying, like we take a lot of these things for granted. But have you ever been to one of these detention centers?
No, no. Never been to a detention center. One, because I barely adjusted my immigration status. So they don't allow DACA recipients or undocumented folks to go inside a detention center.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because in Washington, I've been sent in to detention centers to interview people. But I'm sure that's just like because you're on the southern border and I'm in the northern border area. There was a few more questions I had about that, but what, like, what is one thing that, like, really upsets you that people have in their mind about the border? Like, the number one thing that really upsets you?
That it's, that people think it's a lawless place, that, you know, people are, you know, running through our border,
mm-hmm.
You know, thinking that it's an open range, you know, like a field. When in reality, it's heavily militarized already. I mentioned earlier, we have Border Patrol, we have Customs, which are two different entities. We have ICE, which is a total different entity. We have the, you know, the Texas Coast Guard. They've sent the U.S. military. We also have the state troopers. We have the local sheriffs, the local police, who all of them, you know, kind of like militarized the border. And also that, you know, a lot of the, I want to say like a good chunk of the Rio Grande Valley already has a border wall or border fence, however people feel more comfortable using the word. But to us, it means the same thing.
So you said a word earlier that like kind of like slapped me in the face, because you kind of gave a little bit of a story behind this when we were at the border and you mentioned shoelaces. When you were with a group of students, you asked them all to pick up whatever shoelaces they found on the ground. And then you, you know, you just, what did you tell them? I know what you told them, but I want you to share it.
So in the Rio Grande Valley where I live, my home is about 10 miles or less from the Rio Grande River, El Rio Grande. And that is one of the places where families are forced to immigrate to the U.S. You know, some of them have that privilege to make it across the river, while some don't. And those who do, you know, they're not over here fighting against Border Patrol. They're not here throwing rocks and, you know, however they're being criminalized or portrayed. You know, they're actually just waiting on the U.S. side, you know, sometimes sitting down, sometimes just tired under a tree, waiting for Border Patrol because they are trying to seek asylum. And once Border Patrol gets there and picks them up, you know, there could be, you know, a mother and a child or mother and two children. And the first thing they do is, you know, have them all sit down on the floor. You know, some of them are in the sun, have been traveling for a long time. And then they give them an order to take off their shoelaces. So picture, you know, a six-year-old girl or, you know, an eight-year-old boy sitting on dirt next to a river, taking off their shoelaces. And then, you know, they put the mothers and the children in a Border Patrol truck and take them to a detention center. So these shoelaces, they're just laying around, you know, across the border in different areas. because Border Patrol doesn't worry, like, you know, you're not going to have any more shoelaces or we're going to give them back. So families go through the whole process of trying to seek asylum in the U.S. without shoelaces, right? This is one of the things or the first things that they leave behind. So whenever the students came, I had one student pick up all the shoelaces that he saw. And afterwards, we went straight into the border wall. And there I explained that, you know, all of these shoelaces represent one person who had made it to the U.S. to seek asylum, and that it can mean their dreams. You know, just like people here have dreams, you know, to go to college, to be a lawyer, a doctor, or, you know, to do whatever they want to do. You know, our communities from Central America who are seeking asylum, they also have that dream, right? And that dream could either stop there on the border when they drop that shoelace, because that means that they're going directly to a detention center where, one, they won't know their family will be separated, or if they'll be deported, or if they'll be reunited with their family, or if one of their family members, you know, just took off that shoelace, but another of their family members didn't make it across the river. So it's, you know, very hard to take in, but it's a reality that we have to portray.
And why the shoelaces first?
Because that's the reason why Border Patrol takes it away, is so that immigrants don't do self-harm. They don't, you know, commit suicide by untying their shoelaces and, you know, choking themselves to death, or, you know, for other precautionary reasons.
So I had spent the whole, like, hour with Abraham and this group of students at the border. And I was like, you know, processing, kind of doing my own thing. And I was fine until we got to this shoelace part. And then I just, like, broke down. And everybody broke down. It was really hard to listen to the fact that, like, that was not just a shoelace. It was someone's dream being left behind.
And one of the things that, you know, while I do this one, I've had the opportunity to go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and there's this exhibit where they have shoes. You know, once you go in there, you see tons and tons of shoes, you know, hundreds of shoes. You smell the leather, you know, so you might smell dirt or whatever you feel. And it's really, really powerful, right? It's not only a powerful vision, it's a powerful smell. It's a, you know, everything in there is powerful. And I think, you know, shoelaces of family members who are seeking asylum have the same, if not more, power, because many of them are being denied the legal right to seek asylum.
All right. So, you know, we could talk forever about the stuff that you do at the border. And of course, I want to hear more about it and unpack it with our listeners. But one of the things that I'm thinking about is, like, how do you cope with all of this? Like, what do you do for yourself since you dedicate so much of your time doing all this organizing work?
So a while back, I actually burned out. You know, I just, my last semester in college, I was actually, you know, had this whole big campaign to open up a dream center, right? So we have over 950 students who are undocumented or DACA recipients on campus.
What campus?
The University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. And our university has never had a dream center, right? They've never had a person, an advisor, or whoever who to help out students who are undocumented. You know, we have the biggest number in the state of Texas. We beat, you know, UT Austin. We beat other big universities. And there was nobody dedicated for that. So I was able to help, you know, lead a campaign to be able to create a coalition, to be able to create a dream center. And, you know, this turned out super well. We were able to, you know, get support from students, support from faculty, from, you know, local community members and other nonprofit organizations and so on. But at the end of it, you know, I was just done. I burned out. And I don't think I've ever told anyone, right? But I burned out so bad. You know, I went through depression. I, you know, didn't know how to cope with it. Nobody taught me how to do it. Like, what do you do when you burn out, right? Right after I graduated, I started my job, right? And it was like this really happy time that I graduated. The university hasn't given my diploma because I owe money, but I don't care. I graduated, right? And then I started working at La Unión del Pueblo Entero, and I still didn't know how to recover from, you know,
all the
burnout.
Work. Yeah.
All the work that I have been doing since 2014, you know, doing, you know, family separations, doing the Dream Center, working on in-state tuition, unaccompanied minors, like all of these things, you know, Senate Bill 4, you know, back to back to back to back to back and so on. So in 2015, while in college, I liked watching soccer, first of all. I'm a big, huge Tigres fan. And I said, you know what, let me put some time away that instead of organizing, I'm going to try to dedicate it to myself. So I picked up girls.
you picked up girls?
Girls. I picked up, not girls, but I picked up a fourth and fifth grade girls soccer team, fourth and fifth boys soccer team. I picked up second and third grade boys flag football team, and it was the best experience of my life. And ever since then, you know, for the past 4 years, I've been doing this volunteer coach for, you know, kids in San Juan, who I think at times want to be NFL superstars.
Mm-hmm.
And I help them, I teach them, you know, the basics of how to kick a ball 101 in soccer, how to run with a ball. And it's the most amazing experience I've ever had, especially because, you know, I don't feel like I have to do this for my community, but I want to do it. And also, you know, being with 20 kids who are learning to play soccer, and you get to share your passion with them. It's one of the most amazing feelings ever, because they're, you know, with their eyes wide open, like trying to learn. And when I started in 2015, right, I made mistakes, right? I was trying to be like a cool coach, but a mean coach, but, you know, like just you're learning and the kids are teaching you everything. And kids are literally the most honest people you would ever see. So they'll tell you like, hey, you're being mean, right?
Yeah.
Or like, hey, we don't get this. And it's a, you know, a learning experience that I get to do.
Do you see yourself doing this for a really long time?
I think so. You know, I actually played in a team for one game in the city league because they were missing this player and I happened to be at the park. So I see myself right in these kids, right? I only played one game and I wasn't good at it. So I see myself in these kids, right, who want to learn how to play soccer, who love soccer, who like soccer, who their parents love soccer. So I think I'll be doing it for a few more years, yeah.
Yeah. So soccer and coaching, but I know there's another thing, actually two more things that just pop into my head that you really like to do. And one I think is actually really funny, which is collecting keychains.
Yes, I actually have a huge collection of keychains. I want to say maybe over 50 of just the places I've been to. So anywhere I go, whether it's, you know, driving, whether it's a layover, whether it's a new city that I get to go, I get a keychain. Like, a must thing is a keychain for my collection. And if anybody lives in another city that I haven't visited,
send me
a keychain from your city. Because I love keychains. It's a thing that you get to carry with you for a long time. And it gets to remind you of like great memories that happened there, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it was, you know, a party or visiting someone special or seeing a beautiful mountain, like the keychains are able to bring you that memory. And they don't go bad, right? Because usually they're made out of metal. And another thing that I really, really love doing is gardening. So
that's the one I was going to bring up.
Yeah, gardening is my passion after being a coach. So in actually a year ago, I was going through this, you know, this huge hard time, and, you know, I don't have money to go talk to, you know, a counselor, a psychiatrist, or, you know, and I try to find a way to cope with what I was going through, with the work that I was doing, and I said, you know what, let me buy some seeds. And I started, where I live, it's like 2 feet of caliche, which is just useless rock who sits on the ground and you can't do anything with it. And you can't plant anything. It's just, you know, stupid rocks who you can't, like, nothing grows on it except grass. And it's like terrible grass, not even cool grass. So I dug out, you know, I just got this shovel and I was like, you know what, I'm going to get 10 feet by 2 feet and 2 feet deep, you know, rectangle of caliche out of my yard. So it's this huge strip that I started digging out, right? And it's super hard to dig out caliche because it's compressed with like the big machineries. And I went to a local field where they grow corn and got some dirt from there. I bought some dirt out of the local flea market, mixed them up, and put in so much soil in there instead of the caliche. And then I threw seeds. I bought a bunch of seeds.
You just threw them all over the place.
I don't know how to grow.
You were like, if they grow, they grow.
Something has to grow, yeah. Whether it's grass or it's something. And then things started growing, right? You know, my parents had bought this rose bush that was in a maceta. I don't know what
it's called.
A pot, yes. A pot. And they've had it there for like a year, right? And it was kind of dying off. And I was like, I'm going to put it in my garden. Worst case scenario, it dies. And it was already dying. Best case scenario, it grows. I put seeds for spearmint or peppermint. I don't know which one it is. And now I have, you know, I have aloe vera. I have spearmint. I have a bush, a rose bush, a mini rose bush that I bought somewhere. I also have a peanut plant, which is super weird because one of my ex-coworkers gave me just raw peanuts. He said, let me plant them, and a peanut plant came out.
Oh, my God.
He gave me my first peanut this season.
Aww.
I have an okra plant.
Aww.
I don't know how to eat okra.
You fry it.
Now I know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a cucumber plant that hasn't given me cucumbers yet, and just the rest are a bunch of flowers that I don't know their names, but they're beautiful. So having this garden, it's kind of like having a child. I've never had a child, but I'm guessing this is what it feels like, because you have to be, you know, watering the plant every day. You have to be patient. Like, I learned to be patient because of my plants. I was just stressing out the first day. Like, why haven't you grown the next day? And it, nothing ever grew until like 2-3 weeks later when just little seedlings started popping up. So it, you know, gave me patience, but also it gave me something to look forward when I got home. You know, I didn't have something to look forward to when I got home besides, you know, my bed and sleep and food. So being able to say, you know what, even though I'm tired, I'm going to go home and I'm going to water the dirt that I laid down in the grass because something has to grow. And now I have a huge garden. It's just...
it's your living altar.
Yeah, it's
what
my
you,
living.
What you give to it, like, gives back to you, right?
Yeah, and my mom actually told me that I have a good hand, a green thumb, because whenever... we were living in Far, which is the city next door. I would cut, you know, at her work, she had like aloe vera and it was like, I don't know, 30 of them just in a big bush. So she would be like, oh, just, you know, pluck them out, right? So I would cut them and like 2 weeks later, it was just back to normal. And she was like, you're really good at this, but the more you pluck out, the more they're going to grow. And other people started doing it and they never grew back, right?
Oh my gosh.
So the
you're gifted.
I'm gifted in gardening in case anybody wants to hire me to start their garden. Just
aww.
Kidding.
I love that. So now that we talked a little bit about that, which brings us to like our main topic of the night after talking about so many things, is you talked about soccer connecting you back to Mexico and you not being able to go back to Mexico at some time. But have you been back?
Yeah. I took one of my first trips in July of 2018.
It's 2018.
So I was able to adjust my immigration status and go from being undocumented to being a DACA recipient to now being a legal permanent resident. And it's this whole thing process. So in July of 2018, I was able to make my first trip back to Monterrey. So I was born in Monterrey at the age of 8. I came to the United States, and at the age of 24, I was able to go back for the first time in my life.
Do you remember what you were like thinking and feeling like?
It was the most nerve-wracking place. I've never been so scared, so anxious, so happy, and so sad at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Of going to another place. So I love traveling. You know, I had the opportunity and the privilege to go to East Coast and West Coast and the Southwest. And I've never felt nervous. I've never felt scared. But going to a place that's about 3 hours, 4 hours away brought in all of these, you know, mixed feelings that I'm actually kind of feeling right now.
Kind of feeling right now. I mean, I think that's pretty normal. Bringing it up invokes some of those feelings, but I just like want to know, like, what is that process like in regards to, like, yes, like, of course it's a lot of paperwork and potentially lawyers and whatnot, but, and a ton of money, but like, what was that like for you emotionally, like going from one to the other? Because I think that psychologically, like, it's hard to just like go of that identity. You might not even see it as an identity, but like, it's hard to separate yourself from that when it's all you've known since you got here. So, like, what was that like for you?
So, I've always taken pride in the place I was born and also the place that I've always lived, which is the U.S. and Mexico. And I'm a big norteño, so from the northern part of Mexico, from Monterrey, and a big Texan. So, the boots represents both, right? It's part of just who I am. But not being back for 2/3 of my life and just having these bits and pieces of memory in my brain of an 8-year-old of, you know, living in Monterrey, I had huge expectations, but at the same time, I had no expectations and just wanted to say, you know, whatever happens, happens. One of the biggest things that I was looking for was seeing one of my brothers, or both of my brothers, who had been deported from the U.S. previously. And I hadn't seen them in about 4 years. So I think that was one of the big things that I was looking for, you know, seeing my brothers again, besides seeing them, you know, through social media or video call or anything like that. And being able to, you know, say, hey, you know, give them a hug, how you doing? But also seeing, you know, my grandma's grave, where, and seeing my grandfather, who I hadn't seen in over, I don't know, so many, 17 years. And then, you know, still remembering saying, you know, I didn't get to see my grandmother pass away. I didn't get to say bye to her. I said bye to her in 2002 and spoke to her on the phone. And after she got Alzheimer's, you know, she didn't remember mm-hmm. who we were. And then eventually she just didn't remember anyone at all. She couldn't speak at the very end. So it was really, really hard for me to.
Hey.
We're recording.
We're still recording. You can just hang out in here.
No,
you're totally fine.
Totally cool, man.
You're totally fine. You're just probably going to hear some of it, which is totally cool.
You get an inside look.
Inside look of what is happening.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was, you know, these huge mixed emotions, you know, seeing my grandmother's graves, being able to see my grandpa, being able to hug my brothers, my aunts, my uncles, cousins, and so on. But at the same time, not knowing the city that I was in, you know. I was born in Monterrey, but I didn't know the streets. You know, I remembered my neighborhood, right? I remember the street that I grew up in, but I didn't know the streets next to it, right? I didn't know their names. I didn't know what they looked mm-hmm. like. And then I remember my grandfather's house, and I didn't remember who lived next door to him, right? So I have like patches of what it looked like. And, you know, sometimes seeing a family member makes you happy. And to me, that did. But then having to call my mother, you know, through video call while I was in Monterrey, while I was with my grandpa, and her, you know, talking to him and then saying, you know, I don't have that opportunity, or she doesn't have that opportunity to be here with me, you know, to hug her sons or hug her dad. It was really like heavy. But I had to, you know, say, hey, you know, it's okay, you know. Even though it's not okay, you know, I have to be okay with it, and I have to live with it somehow.
Did you experience anything that really frightened you, either on your way back or to Mexico?
So whenever I was in the Rio Grande Valley, before even leaving to Monterrey, I crossed into Reynosa walking, right? So Reynosa had been known for a while back for being a dangerous city because of the cartels. Monterrey have also had that thing going because it was a dangerous city because of the cartels and so on. So my family internalized that it was a dangerous city and that it was a dangerous trip. And while I didn't want to internalize that, I still felt it because of my family members. So during the bus ride to and from Reynosa, Monterrey, Monterrey, Reynosa, I was, you know, a little scared, a little iffy. It was, you know, a 4-hour bus ride by myself. And I didn't know what to expect, right? I didn't know if, you know, we were going to get stopped. And then being there in Monterrey, right, one of my aunts, you know, she took me in. And, you know, I stayed with her the time that I was there. And I have one of my cousins who, you know, has had the opportunity to come to the U.S. with a visa. And when hanging out with her and hanging out with her friends, I was labeled as the other, right? Mm-hmm. So in the States, I'm always like, oh, you know, he's undocumented. He's a DACA recipient. He was born in Mexico. But then being over there and being labeled as el foráneo, like the foreigner, mm-hmm. you know, I was like, well, where do I fit, right? Like, and I asked them why, right? And they said, well, you know, you don't speak Spanish. And while I was talking Spanish, like, what do you mean I'm talking Spanish right now? So, well, yeah, you talk a different Spanish that nobody talks. Mm. And I kind of felt left out. But at the same time, I was kind of like in that place of Selena, where her dad's like, you have to be, you know, better than the Americans and better than the Mexicans to be able to fit in any of them. So it was really tough for me to try to like be comfortable in Monterrey.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing because you make fun of my Spanish all the fucking time. So I'm like trying to picture myself in Mexico and just being like, not surviving whatsoever.
Yeah, and they feed, like, weed you out right away, you know. It was just a regular hangout, mm-hmm. and we were just talking, and they were just weirded out about my Spanish. And to me, I speak great Spanish, right? I speak Spanish better than a lot of the people that I know, but it wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, well, that it was.
Is there anything else that you kind of want to share about that experience? Because I know it's heavy, right? Like, I know that you have you haven't shared this with a lot of people. I know that you're still processing it, and you mentioned you still feel anxious talking about it. So, like, I don't know, what else are you willing to share about that?
Another thing that I saw is that Mexico is really racist and really discriminates against people
indigenous folks
with more melanin in their skin. And also indigenous folks. So I'm a not only a Latinx person, but I'm also, you know, a darker skinned Mexican. So, you know, even though I was, you know, coming from the U.S. and labeled as a foreigner, you know, whenever I would go to a mall or whenever I would go somewhere to eat, people didn't see me as a better Mexican because of my skin color. So I had, you know, the chance to prove it whenever we went to a restaurant, and I was waiting for a while with my cousin. A white Mexican couple walked in. You know, we were there for like 5 to 10 minutes. A white Mexican couple went in, and then the waiter went straight to them and then went to us. So even though sometimes they see, you know, Americans as, you know, more elite than Mexicans, they still have that discrimination against people that are brown. And, you know, I was, through my skin, I was at a lower level than a lot of the lighter skinned Mexicans there. So it was, you know, it was just, you know, toll after punch, mm-hmm. after punch that I had to take. And I didn't know how to take it. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know how to cope with it. I didn't know what to do about it. You know, I felt like I was, you know, useless or not powerful to do something about it. Because it's their whole system who sees this.
Yeah. What are some of the images that pop up when you think about that trip? And I mean, you've told me one, and I'm not going to say it. Like, you're free to say it if you want to. But, like, what are some of the images that come up when you think about this experience? And I know you've been back since, but, I mean, that first time being as nerve-wracking as it was, as exciting, and also just, like, various things.
The one that stands out the most is being able to share a meal with my two brothers at a restaurant that our parents used to take us when we were like 6, 7 years old. So I do have this memory of like our parents taking our whole family to Taqueria La Mexicana in Monterrey, in downtown area. And, you know, fast forwarding from 8 years, 6 years to 24 years old and walking into that restaurant and not knowing what to expect, you know, just having that little memory of what it was and then trying to relive it was like a happy moment, especially, you know, living it with my brothers and so on. Another thing is the Cerro de la Silla. So Monterrey is known because of its mountains. And there's this, you know, mountain that looks like a horse saddle. And, you know, getting to Monterrey and, you know, walking out of the bus station and, you know, looking east or southeast and seeing the big mountain, you know, I felt home. Like, I felt like that's where destiny had taken me, and that's where, you know, it was like a closing chapter of like from leaving to coming back.
And what was it like coming back? Because I can imagine that coming back was a totally different experience where you were processing this thing that you are not undocumented anymore. I'm sure you felt like guilt and shame, but also like, of course, relief and happiness. So like, I don't know, what was that trip back like?
So it was 4 hours on a bus from Monterrey to Reynosa. And it was the longest 4 hours of my life. One, because I was thinking of like everything that had happened, you know, mm-hmm. seeing my grandpa, seeing my grandmother's grave, getting to see my brothers, getting to see family members, going out to places where I went as a child, and then saying, you know, I have the privilege to be able to go back to my mom and, you know, be welcomed with a plate on the table. And my brother doesn't have that opportunity, right? So my brother is still low income, is still living in poverty. Opportunities suck. He doesn't have that luxury of saying, you know, I graduated high school, because he didn't have that opportunity in the U.S. Because of the many obstacles. He didn't find a way to, you know, put his studies from the U.S. into Mexico. He didn't have an ID and all this stuff. So it was just a big privilege that I have over my brother that I still also had to process, but also going back and being scared at the border, because I was getting dropped off at the Reynosa bus station, taking a taxi to the International Crossing Bridge, and then walking through the International Crossing Bridge back into the U.S. for the first time in my life. So being in line, you know, it was a fairly short line, and standing in front of a Border Patrol officer, a customs officer, and asking, like, where did you go? Why did you go there? Who did you go with? Who did you meet with? And asking me all these questions that intimidated me, because every interaction that I could possibly have with the Border Patrol or ICE or Customs before I had legal status was going to be negative, mm-hmm. until this point. So I crossed that time with ease, and, you know, even though they asked me all these questions, I was able to go back to the States, cross into the U.S., you know, and go back home with my family. So the whole trip, you know, it's just, you know, a like emotional punch after another one. And they just piled up, right? They just piled up, and you try to stay positive, but at the same time, it's hard to stay positive.
Yeah. So let's have a sip of our drink before we move on to the next section. It's like too much for me to like process. So I wonder how like people are listening to this and how they're feeling about it. But what is there anything else that you want to say about that transition from undocumented to legal permanent resident?
It's really tough. A year later, I haven't had, you know, that opportunity to be in peace yet, mm-hmm. because I still have family members who are undocumented, who still every day run that risk of being deported, being detained, put in a detention center. And you can't be at peace with that. You can't be comfortable. So while I have the privilege of being able to go back to Mexico, you know, go on a weekend to Reynosa to go eat, to go shop, coming back, you know, it's still in my mind of like, what if they don't let me back into the U.S.? Or what happens if a family member is, you know, in trouble?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a couple more things I want to touch on. We'll make them kind of quick. But I know that you submitted a TED Talk to, what was it? What's the theme again? We Are Dreamers?
TEDx McAllen is going on in November of 2019. And the theme is We Are Dreamers. So there's this, you know, whole positive, negative issue of dreamers and the way they're portraying it, of literally the way it is as somebody who dreams and somebody who has dreams. But then there's the immigration one of like immigrant youth who came to this country through persecution, through their choice, through their family members, through no choice of their own, being called dreamers. And then I was in the limbo of like, should I do mine on something? So I submitted one that hit home. And for y'all get the intel. they do approve it. Hopefully it'll be on linguistic terrorism and how language has played a huge role in my life. Growing up, while going back to Mexico, at my high school graduation, where my mother didn't understand a word they said, not even my name, because they said my name in English. How the university that I attended is the first one in the country to be bilingual, biliterate, and bicultural. But at the graduation, the only word my mom understood was bienvenidos. And then the rest was in English. So all of this, you know, how it played and impacted my life. So hopefully they do approve it. I'm really crossing my fingers, and everybody listening too should do theirs too.
And just so you know, I recommended this fucker for this TED Talk. And he was like, someone submitted a submission for me, like a nomination. And I was like, it was really hard to say nice things.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
And you make fun of my Spanish all the time. So I kind of can't stand you right now, but that's okay. So before we do our closeout and our final question, do you have any questions for me?
No.
No? Okay. So the main question that we always ask, and you know it because you've heard me ask it 150 times, what does your liberation look like?
What does my liberation look like? So I actually took a 5-hour bus from McAllen to San Antonio last night from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. And I was thinking, what does my liberation look like?
And he pulled out his notes.
Yeah, and I was writing all these things, right? I was like,
he knew I was gonna ask.
I knew you were gonna ask. I was prepared, and I wanted to prepare myself, but I couldn't. Right? It's just, and to me, liberation is like where I'll be comfortable and relieved, right? So, and I asked, you know, I think I was sitting on that bus ride for 30 minutes, just staring at the front seat, thinking, what would make me be comfortable with life? Like, shit could go down, and if this happened, I'll be fine. And the first image that came to my mind was my mom, right? So my mom has played an important role in my life. She's the strength that has gotten me through high school, college, through the work that I do, has always supported me, whether she approves it or not, whether she likes it or not. She's always been like, I don't think you should do it, and I'm scared, but I'm going to support you. Mm. And what I wrote down was that taking my mother back to Mexico and healing her traumas, all the traumas, whether that happened as a child or when she was, you know, immigrating to the U.S. or while she's been in the U.S., being able to heal those traumas with her and being able to be, you know, somebody she could lean on, I think that would liberate me from a lot. And I think whatever happened, I think I'd still be in peace.
So we've gotten to the point of the selfish plug. And we were talking about your selfish plug earlier, and I thought it was kind of funny. So let's hear it.
So for all of you listeners, I think two plugs. The first one, I'm a volunteer coach who teaches, I think, 20 to 30 fourth, fifth graders, boys and girls. If y'all want to make a donation so that I can buy soccer balls, flags for flag football, footballs, you know, shorts and all the stuff, usually comes out of my pocket for my kids. I'd be more than happy to take any and all donations, whether it's material things or monetary. So I guarantee you 100% they will all go to the kids, and I won't spend it on alcohol.
God, isn't that his Shiner beer?
The second one is to support the border communities who are doing a lot of work. There's great organizations who are, you know, spearheading work in the Rio Grande Valley and other border communities across the U.S. To name a few, I can say Angry Tías and Abuelas, I can say Texas Civil Rights Project, La Unión del Pueblo Entero, you know, all these organizations have been doing tremendous work to support families who are trying to seek asylum. So making any monetary donations or donating goods would definitely help not only the Rio Grande Valley, but also support the work that we're doing.
So in our show notes, we will link all of that information and his Venmo and email address if you want to contribute. But the last thing I kind of want to end on was really funny. Before we started recording, our friend Alex was in here and he was like, can you make sure to record and tell your listeners that Abraham is one of the hottest guys in our fellowship? And we started laughing about it and it got kind of awkward, but Alex wanted me to tell you, you're one of the hottest guys in the fellowship.
Thank you, Alex. You too. I love you. And oh, the listeners, thank you all for supporting Shadow Troop Podcast. If you are listening to this, make sure to at least recommend it to one more person. And once they listen to it, to make sure that they recommend it to someone else. Because Vicky's doing amazing work.
He's so annoying.
And thank you for the work,
Vicky. Oh my gosh, I can't stand you. Love y'all. Anything else?
That'll be it.
All right. Well, that was a shot of truth. Bye. Say bye.
Bye.